Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 22nd of February. This hour of the program, the author of I Is an Other, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the way we see the world. James Geary is our guest. He is the author of Geary's Guide to the World's Great Aphorists and the New York Times bestseller, The World in a Phrase, A Brief History of the Aphorism. He spent the better part of a year in the British Library looking up every book that had metaphor in the title, which explains the very long bibliography that accompanies his book. It took only a year after doing the research to write the book, but he's been studying language ever since he was a kid. He was interested in writing literature and poetry and obsessively interested in language. And since he was eight, he was collecting aphorisms. It's amazing as you read the book and you start thinking about the fact that we think metaphorically, the number of metaphors that we use in every sentence of our daily lives. So we're using them constantly. How do we describe them? Well, we'll ask him Aristotle's definition, giving a thing a name that belongs to something else. Or how about this? X equals Y. We'll welcome phone calls for our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook address is The Kathleen Dunn Show, so you have many ways you can communicate with us during the course of this hour. James, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. It is. I never thought about the fact that we think metaphorically, and after you start reading your book, you realize it's all over the place. We just don't realize that it's metaphors.
That's right. They metaphors are ubiquitous. They're absolutely everywhere. From, you know, the most lofty, soaring. Whoops! I just used two metaphors there. Sorry, lofty and soaring. Lofty, soaring political speeches to, you know, everyday interpersonal transactions when you tell someone, you know, how you feel. You're feeling up today, you're feeling down today. That's a very basic form of metaphor. So you're right. They're absolutely everywhere, all around us, all the time.
Do you go with that Aristotle definition, or do you have another one?
Well, I would never presume to improve on a definition by Aristotle. I think that's a very good definition, a very simple one. But in addition to giving a name that belongs to something else, a metaphor actually gives a host of associations as well. And I think it's that is really where the hidden power of metaphor lies. Because when you give something a specific name, along with that name come a host of ideas and associations and connections and memories. And all those, that kind of swirl of associations is where the power of metaphor lies.
Does that imply that because we're born with very few of those associations, we use more metaphors as we grow older?
That's an interesting question. Certainly the sophistication of our metaphor use increases with age. So, for example, if you, very interesting studies with children have been done where they've been given a variety of metaphors to see how they comprehend them or if they comprehend them. And children are very adept at understanding very simple metaphors like, you know, the sun is a plate or something like that, a metaphor that's based on a very simple physical resemblance. And I'm sure, you know, parents will be able to cite the wonderful metaphorical things their children have said. I remember when my eldest son was two, we were looking out the window one day, and he pointed to the sun, and he said, "Big sky lamp." And, you know, that's a beautiful, incredible metaphor, but it's based purely on physical resemblance of, you know, the sun is something that gives light, and a lamp is something that gives light. What children have much more difficulty with is complex sort of psychological metaphors when you're describing someone's personality. Like you say, you know, he's hard as a rock or she's very sweet or something like that. Simple metaphors that adults understand very readily as descriptions of a personality, children would think, the person is actually physically hard or is physically sweet. And it's only when we all enter adolescence and we start having a wider range of emotional and psychological experiences, that we begin to understand the more complex psychological metaphors that we use every day.
This one has always struck me as a knockout, and you make reference to it in the book. It is the East and Juliet is the Sun. I love that one.
Yeah, that's, Shakespeare, gosh.
Yeah, I mean, Shakespeare.
Yeah, what can you say about Shakespeare and his use of metaphor? It's really astounding. And a metaphor like that, you'll come across that metaphor, Juliet is the Sun, in almost every sort of academic paper on metaphor. But it's actually, it's interesting you mention that, because it's a really good example of the way that metaphor is not just, it's a good Aristotelian example of metaphor, because Juliet is given the name of something else. She's given the name of the sun. And it's a very simple X equals Y equation. Juliet is the sun. Juliet equals the sun. But along with that name come all these associations of Juliet is hot.
Yes.
And clearly Romeo has the hots for her, and that's an association with the sun. But also he's attracted by her gravitational pull. They sort of orbit, their fates orbit around each other. And also, if you get too close to Juliet, you get burned, as Romeo found out in the play. So, with in a simple metaphor of like four words, you've got these huge sort of existential associations swirling around, and that's what makes a metaphor so complex and so fun to untangle.
But Shakespeare never said Juliet is hot in the way that we think of hot in these days.
No, he didn't, that's a later metaphorical usage.
Yes.
But it's another really good example of the way whenever we talk about, abstract or emotional or psychological things, we use metaphors of physicality. So, if we want to say someone is sexually attractive, we say they're hot. If we have a bad day at the office, we say we've had a rough day at the office. Silence can be sweet. We always, whenever we're talking about our emotional experience, we sort of instinctively reach for physical metaphors.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Elvis Presley and metaphors. I know he makes his way into your book. I shake things up, therefore I am.
That's right. Well, All Shook Up is, Elvis is one of my favorites, and All Shook Up is one of my favorite songs. And I cite Elvis and Aristotle, actually, because one of the important things that I think about metaphor is that it's not just Shakespeare, it's not just literature, it's not just poetry. Metaphor is present in daily life, and as you were saying in the introduction, in many ways is a sort of fundamental aspect of how we interact with each other. And All Shook Up is a wonderful example of that, in my view, because the lyrics of the song are just a series of metaphors or similes, if you want to use the technical term, because a lot of them have, like in it. Her lips were like a volcano that's hot. But for me, it also has to do with the sort of fundamental role that metaphor plays in our thinking, because I relate it to Descartes' grand dictum that I think, therefore I am. But the actual etymological root of the word cogito, which means to think, originally meant to shake up. And for me, that's what metaphor does. Metaphor shakes up the sort of logical order of things and rearranges it into surprising new combinations. And it's through those combinations that we actually learn. Because whenever we're sort of encountering something new or something unknown, the way that we describe it is by comparing it to something that we already know. And to learn something new, we have to, in a way, shake up the things that we already know and put them in new combinations. And those combinations are very often metaphors.
And he even did it with his body. Didn't
right.
he?
But that's another great example of metaphor, because he was called Elvis the Pelvis.
Right.
And that's when you describe someone using like a specific aspect of their body or their personality, that's a certain kind of metaphor. But Elvis the Pelvis, he's for me one of the great philosophers of metaphor.
Hmm.
King of the metaphorians, we should call him.
I remember my parents were just outraged by his behavior, and I thought he was really cool or hot, although I didn't realize what that meant in those days, and I was just a
Elvis
kid.
Is the sun. son.
Elvis was the son, right? And I wanted to see, I think it was a movie, Jailhouse Rock, and I wanted to go to the downtown Desplaines Theater, and my parents said, absolutely not. I must have been 8 years old, and I took the bus down there. I disobeyed them completely because it was, Elvis was the son.
It's fantastic. You are a very young rebel.
Oh, I've been a rebel for a long time, yeah. I would imagine that this language interest that you have is just something that's with you every moment of your day, isn't it? I can see you sitting in the library and just going crazy with all of this.
Yes, I think I do. I am a bit extreme there, and it's not just in the library, but I think one of the wonderful things that I've found in researching the book on metaphor is that I've become sort of hyper-aware to it, and because it's all over the place, and once you...
Yes.
It doesn't take much. Once you get sort of... You tune into the wavelength. There's another metaphor, by the way. If you tune into the wavelength, you can start spotting the metaphors absolutely everywhere. And it is really quite entertaining, I have to say. If you're listening to the news or you're just listening to ordinary conversation, or you're reading the newspaper, or you're watching a movie, suddenly these metaphors will start lighting up all over the place. And it's interesting because I think, you know, another fascinating aspect of metaphor is that it reveals a lot about the people who use the metaphors. So if you choose a particular metaphor to describe your significant other, for example, that says a lot about your feelings towards that person. So you can learn a lot about how people are thinking, because often they give away things in a metaphor that they wouldn't give away consciously. But also, if you sort of step back and forget for a minute the metaphorical meaning of some common phrases that we use every day, like, there's an elephant in the room or something like that, and you think about the literal meaning for a minute, it becomes really, really funny when you... When you think about what we are literally saying to each other and compare that with what we are sort of emotionally and psychologically understanding when we say those things, it's really quite entertaining and like I said, can be quite revealing.
I found the chapter fascinating, the story of Rebecca, who has Asperger's syndrome, and what happens to people when they don't incorporate metaphors into their lives. They don't understand them.
Yeah. That's. I also found that both fascinating and very, very distressing to speak with her. And Rebecca, that's not her real name, by the way. She didn't want me to use her real name in the book. But she suffers from Asperger's syndrome, which is a kind of autism spectrum disorder. And one of the characteristics of Asperger's is that people with that condition have really enormous difficulty understanding the simplest metaphors. So, for example, if I were to say to Rebecca, you know, nobody wants to talk about the elephant in the room, she would think there is an actual literal elephant in the room. If you would use an expression like, he's a big fish in a small pond, she would interpret that literally and think, you know, he's actually some kind of a fish somehow, and that's so weird. A very sort of telling example was when I met her, she arrived at our appointment, and she had a newspaper clipping in her hand, and the headline read, "Belt Tightening Lies Ahead."
Yes.
And she had no idea what that meant. She thought, is this an article about fashion? Is it an article about belts? I don't wear a belt. What does this article have to do with me? And the metaphorical meaning of, you know, we're in tough economic times and people have to cut their budgets completely escaped her. Now, the reason for this, or at least the theory, is that people with autism spectrum disorders have a malfunctioning mirror neuron system, which is believed to be the brain cells that help us understand what other people are thinking and empathize with other people and, in a way, sort of psychologically put ourselves in other people's shoes. And that's exactly what metaphor does, you know, by... When someone tells you how they feel, you know, they compare it. They feel up, they feel down, they feel sick as a dog, high as a kite. We compare how we feel to something that's not how we feel, and that's how we understand how we comprehend each other. People with this condition, Asperger's syndrome, can't do that, and they can't understand the metaphors. So you can imagine how distressing it is if in your daily interactions with people you can't understand 90% of the things that they're trying to say.
Oh my, yes.
And a kind of funny and tragic example is Rebecca's an avid rock climber, and she joined a new club, and the owner of the club came over and said, "Oh, welcome, come on in, and I'll show you the ropes." And she thought, "Why are you going to show me the ropes? I'm already a climber. I know what a rope is. I know how to, you know, I know how they work." And she completely missed the warm sort of emotional invitation that the instructor was giving her. And she even uses something called the Asperger's Dictionary of Everyday Expressions, and it's a dictionary of metaphors. So things like Trojan horse, when it's describing computer viruses, the devil's advocate, very, very simple metaphors that we use every day that she doesn't understand. When she encounters them in daily life, she goes home that evening and looks them up. And you can imagine what a sort of deficit that is in terms of being able to relate emotionally to people and to have friendships and to nurture social relationships.
Right. And probably impossible to be able to take poetry into your life or read poetry, is it?
Yeah, she doesn't get poetry. She has a very, very difficult time with novels. She can't watch films because metaphor, I think it's also important to point out, metaphor is not just, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, it's not just a matter of language, it's a matter of thinking. So there's also, our body language is also metaphorical. A thumbs up sign, for example, or the okay sign, or, you know, sitting with your arms crossed across your chest, those are all sort of metaphorical signs that indicates something about how a person's feeling, and Rebecca can't understand those either. So she's incredibly good at math, and she has a very, very logical mind. So she's exceptional in some areas, but when it comes to anything that relies on figurative language or indirection or social nuance, she really, really struggles, and she feels... I mean, she feels that. She feels very isolated and, is very distressed by the challenges this presents in terms of her social life and professional life, for that matter.
Yes. We're going to go to phone calls in a moment. Let's start with an email, though. I wonder if James has any observations about how many people, especially those of an authoritarian or fundamentalist disposition, have great difficulty discerning metaphor from literal factual reality.
Wow, that's a very...
you got to love our audience.
That's a well-phrased question,
yes.
I think. Obviously, religious texts, spiritual texts from any of the world's great religions are, in my view, from beginning to end, almost nothing but metaphors and myths. And myths are, in many ways, extended and very elaborate metaphors. They're metaphors in story form. I think it's less in this case a question of people having, like people with autism spectrum disorders, a sort of physical inability to understand metaphor, but they, you know, interpret metaphors, some metaphors they don't consider to be metaphors, they consider to be literal truth, whereas, you know, they would have no trouble knowing that, you know, no one's talking about the elephant in a room does not refer to an actual elephant. But I think religious texts in particular are very, very interesting because the use of metaphor there can't be another area of our lives as abstract and conceptual and sort of immaterial as religion and spirituality. And naturally, whether we're writing about our experience of spirituality or reading sacred texts about it, it has to be metaphor because it can, in fact, many, many religious texts are exactly about how inexpressible the experience of spirituality is. So we have to use metaphor to describe that, and because there's no other way to describe it directly, because it's not something, it's not a thing that can be experienced. It's more a state. And many of the great mystics from all religious traditions use beautiful, beautiful metaphors, and often they use the metaphor of lovers. You know, that the supreme being or the god, in whatever religion it is, the experience of that unity with that spirit is described in the context of a loving physical or spiritual platonic relationship, because that's the nearest thing that we can experience and share that is like what it's like to be you know, caught up in that kind of spiritual experience. And again, the fact that I have to use the word like, what is it like, is also an indication that there's no other way to describe these kind of things without metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Phone calls momentarily. Our guest is James Geary. He is the author of I Is an Other, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the Way We See the World. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, I was interested in Gene's show this afternoon. We're going to be looking at the Middle East tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour. We have had so many programs because what's going on in Wisconsin keeps on keeping on for all of us. The intensity of the story, the demonstrations, the Democratic senators in Illinois, the governor appearing, and we want him to appear in our show. Once again, a request to the governor to be with us. Press conferences talking about our fiscal house. And so we're going to just take a little break because the news from the Middle East is so all-encompassing as well, and major, major stories. So that will be the focus of our 9 o'clock. On Thursday at 9 o'clock, we will be speaking with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and also with former Republican Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow, looking at the continuing story and the issues with the budget repair bill here in Wisconsin. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Well, back to phone calls. Let's go to phone calls. John in Madison is our first caller. Hi, John.
Good morning, James and Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Interesting topic, and I was listening to the examples of metaphors. I was wondering if you draw a distinction between idioms and metaphors in the way you understand metaphors, because it seems like a lot of idioms are themselves metaphors, but I wonder if it's what kind of a relationship it is it really. And then another question or a comment maybe is when you mention some people's inability to comprehend metaphors, maybe on a fundamental neurological level, I suppose I had the same type of experience when I moved to this country, and that was a long time ago, but I did not speak the language, and so as my language ability improved, I still, the hardest part was actually understanding the unusual uses of language, which were not in any dictionary.
Where are you from, John?
From Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So it, and of course, Russian language or Estonian language would have its own metaphors that are not literally translatable, and or some of them could be actually. There are actually a bunch of metaphors that could be translated literally and understood by both people or both cultures, but a lot of them cannot be. And so it was an interesting confusion.
Oh, I imagine.
Over time, though, well, the way I imagine there are some metaphors or idioms I still wouldn't understand. If I heard them now, there are very few, but I imagine there are, slang especially. And the way I look at it, though, is the kind of an adaptation or a way to deal with it has been to simply understand that there are things you can't understand in a language, and rather than try to understand everything literally, if it doesn't make sense literally, you just say, all right, well, there is something I don't understand, I'll have to look it up.
James, there's a lot there.
No, I think that's a very interesting point, John. First of all, I would say that idioms are metaphors, just like proverbs and parables and myths. They all work, and aphorisms. Kathleen was mentioned my obsession with aphorisms earlier. These are all forms of language that rely on metaphor to communicate their message. And in fact, the reason that idioms and proverbs, you know, let sleeping dogs lie, for example, what the hell does that mean? but the reason they can be so short is because the metaphor does all the work. rather than explain at great length and in great detail about how when, you know, a potentially troublesome situation is not currently causing a lot of trouble, say, like the Middle East a few weeks ago, it's better to let sleeping dogs lie. You can say that in just, you know, a handful of words, and that's an idiom, a proverb, but it's the metaphor that's doing the work. And from, you know, as someone who is a non-native English speaker, I can really relate to your incomprehension of some American metaphors, because I lived in the Netherlands for 7 years.
Oh, you did?
I speak Dutch, and my wife is Dutch. And one of the great idioms, or a lot of the idioms in Holland, have to do with the sea, because the sea is such a has been such a historical enemy of the Netherlands, and half the country is below sea level and all that stuff. And one of my favorite idioms from the Dutch language, which completely threw me for a loop when I first heard it, is to it's a saying that goes, you know, that doesn't put any sod on the dike. Which is essentially a way of saying when you're doing something that's not achieving the desired result, you know, you better stop doing it. It doesn't put any sod on the dike. And when I heard that used in conversation, I thought, you know, I felt like, you know, Rebecca must feel a lot of the time. I thought, what is this person talking about? Sod, dike? What does this have to do with anything? So I think it's we all have I think everywhere there's certain metaphors that are sort of common to every culture and every language, but then as John was saying, there are metaphors that are distinct to specific languages and specific cultures, and without a knowledge or some knowledge of that language and culture, you'll never get the metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John. Great call. Tom is calling next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I really enjoy your guest this morning. I just want to tell you about how a metaphor can sometimes get you in a lot of trouble. Same type of thing, don't let sleeping dogs lie. I was having a conversation one day with some people about problem solving, and a common, I don't even know where this came from, but it's something that's always been used, maybe in just our area, our culture, but there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they looked at me horrified, like, oh, some type of animal abuser.
Oh.
Yeah, be careful about that. And I never thought about it that way before, so I don't use that metaphor anymore. I just wanted to share that with you. I thought it was awful funny.
I see your point. It would keep me from using that as well.
But I think that's a really fantastic example, and it's very funny, but it's also a good example of the power of metaphor, because they do, you know, a metaphor like that, it sort of clicks into this whole other realm that, you know, can either, that can pan out in a way you don't really expect. And you know, this happens on very, very subtle levels, and you know, studies have been done that show the power of very simple words, the power that these metaphors have on people's behavior. For example, a group of people was given an innocuous text to read that contained words like gray and Florida and bingo, and of course, all those words are associated with elderly people living in Florida, and these people were then asked to go walk down the hallway. And the people who had read the text with gray, bingo, and Florida in it, they walked slower than people who had read a different text without those words in it. And the conclusion of the study was that those words had kind of unconsciously triggered a metaphorical association with elderly people. So these people walked slower and more carefully, like elderly people do. And the same results have been achieved in all kinds of different experiments, which, when you first hear about them, sound really wacky, but they've been replicated over and over, and it shows the real potency of what we would consider, you know, very sort of pedestrian metaphors.
Here's an interesting email. Without Shakespeare's prose, I suppose you can assume that a person named Juliet can be compared to the sun, but is Juliet round like the sun, obese, bright as the sun, intellectually, hot as the sun, aesthetically? Who's to know, who's to decide, and in what context is the comparison to be taken?
That's an excellent question, and it's also another of the remarkable aspects of metaphor, because the person who sent the email is absolutely right. When you say Juliet is the sun, why don't we compare her to all those other aspects of the sun, you know, that are also true, but somehow we don't come to the conclusion that they apply to Juliet. And the way that we do this, there's a philosopher called Max Black who came up with the idea of associated commonplaces. And what associated commonplaces are sort of a framework that provides the context for understanding any given metaphor. But crucially, like we were discussing in terms of idioms and foreign languages, you need to know the context. So to understand a metaphor like Juliet is the sun, we need the context of the play Romeo and Juliet, and we need to know about their relationship and the obstacles to their relationship. Once you have those facts, then our brain just kind of sorts through all the potential combinations of associations with Juliet and the sun, and comparing those to the context, it selects, or we select, which ones are most likely to apply. And the famous example that Max Black himself used is a very, very old metaphor, man is a wolf. So, you know, when I say man is a wolf, people don't think, well, man must have four legs, must, be a litter-bearing animal that lives in the woods. No, we think again of Shakespeare, that lean and hungry look. Mm-hmm. Man is greedy, man is sly, man is vicious. And we know that because, or we alight, so to speak, on those associations because of the context that we have, because we know what man is, we know what human beings are. We've had experiences of people who are wolves, and maybe wolves in sheep's clothing even. Mm-hmm. So, and again, this goes back to what we're talking about with children. Children would not understand man as a wolf. They would not understand that metaphor at all, not until they've had experiences themselves of people who are wolves. So it's the context that sort of directs our interpretation of any given metaphor.
Walter in Duluth, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Walter.
Hello.
Hello.
First, thank you for the conversation. This is very interesting. I'm wondering if the speaker is familiar with Emanuel Swedenborg.
I am, but not in the context of metaphor, so please enlighten me.
He was a 17th century scientist turned mystic, and claims that when he was 56 years old, an angel visited him, and that there was an inner spiritual meaning in the Bible, that though we can understand it, and we have on a literal level, that all those things, trees and rivers and lakes and all the names, have a specific spiritual idea behind them. So you get, okay, poets like Blake and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, they're very Swedenborgian. Emerson, before he kind of took Swedenborg or took God out of it, but so much of his theology is this law of correspondence, is what he called it.
That's
that
right.
Things
yeah.
here physically correspond to something on the spiritual realm.
Hmm.
That's right, and I think that's that's a very interesting point. And Emerson is I'm a huge fan of Emerson, and he's featured prominently in the book as well, and. That is, coming back to the question about religious metaphors and interpreting them literally or not, what I believe poets like Swedenborg and philosophers and theologians are trying to communicate an inner experience that is, at its essence, totally inexpressible. How can they do that? By choosing a metaphor that represents that experience from the natural world. And why is the natural world so popular as a metaphor for this kind of thing? It's because it's something that we all experience or that we're all familiar with. And again, it comes back to context. For a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening like the one that Swedenborg describes or Emerson describes, that's such a, you know, in many ways, it's such a out of the realm of our daily ordinary experience. That the way to make it comprehensible and familiar is to describe it in terms of ordinary experience that we all share. And again, you know, whether Swedenborg or you know others really think there is divinity in the tree, or it's a metaphorical way of understanding the beauty and divinity of all life, that's for the individual to decide him or herself. It remains, in my opinion, a metaphor in either case, and an incredibly potent one.
You write in the book that metaphor has been condemned for promoting deception and subversion. Rightfully condemned?
Well, I think I don't know. I think sometimes when you use the word metaphor, people think it's not true. And, you know, that you're just dealing with figurative language and it's a sort of a frilly, flowery use of language that doesn't really get down to nuts and bolts or you know, get real work done in the real world. But that is a point of view that I think that I totally disagree with. What I don't think is that there is no such thing as literal truth. There obviously is, and there are facts, and there are, you know, physical facts and scientific facts and all kinds of facts. But there are also metaphorical facts. And the metaphorical facts are just as true and just as relevant and just as important as the other kind of facts. And I think, you know, during the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, metaphor was seen as just a, you know, it's just something that's a harmless diversion that, that poets engaged in. But as we've just been discussing, I think metaphor is at the core of what it is to be a human being and what it is to be creative as a human being, because I think innovation, discovery, learning, it is all aided and abetted by metaphor. When, you know, when we want to understand what an atom is, how it works and what it is, we describe it, it's like a solar system. And again, that's a way of conveying scientific discoveries and new information through metaphor. So far from being, you know, a sort of sideline of human evolution, I think the metaphor is at the core.
Mm. Thank you very much, Walter. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Yeah, it's interesting. In a way, I see metaphors and proverbs as very closely linked. And to tie your show about Peace Corps yesterday, Kathleen, with this, when I was in Mali in West Africa as a volunteer, I was trying to decide whether to stay for a third year. Turned out we couldn't, but in the interim, I was trying to make a decision. And my very best friend, Usman, said to me in Bambara, a proverb that roughly translated is, no matter how long a tree trunk stays in the water, it can't become a crocodile, to tell me that I had gotten pretty much out of everything out of the experience I was going to. But then, because he was my best friend, he looked at me, smiled, rubbed his arm, he says, but it does darken up a little bit.
That's a lovely story. And in fact, it's very interesting you mentioned that. There's a whole chapter in the book on proverbs and the metaphors of proverbs. And a lot of it is about Africa, because Africa is, just as you explained, Africa is a place where proverbs like still exist as a kind of oral tradition, where they're exchanged on a daily basis in key situations, you know, key moments of emotional intensity, like the one you were experiencing with your friend. And again, it's a wonderful example of how literature is life. You know, literature is something we live and experience every day. It's not something we just read about in books. And proverbs and metaphors and aphorisms are the primary vehicles that we sort of share this oral tradition with each other. And, you know, by telling that little proverb is like a little fable contained in just a few words, but by, you know, giving you what seems like on the surface a complete non sequitur, you understand a lot about your situation, and crucially, you understand a lot about your friend and mm-hmm. how perceptive your friend is about you and what you're going through.
Oh, that's a gem. Thank you so much, Jeff, for the call. Very nice. Paul in Duluth, hi.
Good morning. I'm sorry I missed the first half of the show. I told the screener that I know what it took me a while, but I figured out what, in political terms, what being thrown under the bus means, okay? I've kind of got that. But there's another one that that really puzzles me called jumping the shark. And I have no idea what that means. And just as a general comment, I really hate sports metaphors when people are talking politics, because I have no idea. I'm not a sports fan. I have no idea what a Hail Mary pass is. And, you know, I hear this kind of stuff all the time, and I feel like I'm, you know, I'm on the outside looking in to a, like a closed club, if you will. And I appreciate your comment.
Thank you, Paul.
Paul, you need to start watching some NFL football games, and you know exactly what a Hail Mary pass is. But a very interesting comment because sports metaphors like the Hail Mary pass are very, very popular in politics, and especially in politics when warfare is being discussed. Huddle during the first Gulf War, the first President Bush was huddled with advisors. They were plotting strategy and the ground game and all these metaphors derived from football. And it's, you know, I'm not familiar with the one jumping the shark. If I heard
I'm
you
not
correctly,
either.
I've never heard that one before, but this is part of the, you know, if you don't understand the metaphor, it might be helpful to regard it for its entertainment value. You know, given the economic crisis and all that's going on in the economy at the moment, we hear all these lovely metaphors about bankers being given a haircut and bankers taking a bath and investors taking a bath and savers taking a bath. And if you think about it, so many metaphors that have to do with money have to do with water or fluid dynamics. You know, we talk about revenue streams. We talk about our stock options being underwater. We talk about a company being solvent. We talk about the need to have liquidity in our investments. And that's a really good example of a metaphor that, a sort of consistent metaphor that springs up in lots of different forms and lots of different places. But they all kind of flow back to the understanding of money as a kind of fluid, as a kind of liquid. Mm. And when you think about it, it's exactly what it is. It's a really apt description of the way that money moves.
We also get a lot of comparisons with animals, don't we? The bear market, the bull market.
Yeah, that's weird.
It is kind of strange.
That, why would bears and bulls? And that's another, I mean, a fascinating study still remains to be done on the etymology of some metaphors. How did it come about that a bear market came to be a bear market? And a bull I can kind of imagine, because you can imagine charging ahead and that kind of aggressive posture. But a bear strikes me as pretty aggressive, too. So I'm not sure where that one comes from. Mm.
We are going to welcome more phone calls, and we have many emails as well. I Is Another is the name of James' book, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the Way We See the World. James Geary is our guest. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The World in a Phrase, A Brief History of the Aphorism. He's been collecting those since he was a young child. 800-486-8655 is the number. Thank you, Paul, very much for the call. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A few announcements for you. Last night, the governor of Wisconsin had a press conference. Tonight, he is having what he is calling a fireside chat addressing the budget repair bill, and it will be carried here on Wisconsin Public Radio at 6 o'clock tonight on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we are going to talk about all that's been going on in Libya and Bahrain and update on Egypt. And then on Thursday, we will return to our continuing examination of the budget repair bill. And our guests will be Thursday at 9, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and former Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow. So that should be a good show as well. And we're all over this issue. It's such a huge story, not only in this state, but all over the country, actually. And, well, I guess you can go beyond the country, too, because there have been pizzas delivered to people in Madison from various places in the world, and camels have been delivered to Madison, and so it goes. So that's what's coming up. You can hear that address tonight on the radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is James Geary. Here are a couple of emails that have come in, James. I'll read both of them. Metaphors are fun, but with no context or reference, they are essentially meaningless. It's all a little too vague for me, just my 2 cents. And then another one. An email from Simon in Wisconsin Rapids. In a recent BBC News interview about China, the reporter used the metaphor dog eat dog. The Chinese official stopped and said, "I don't understand. I don't eat dogs." We go next to Jill in Madison. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'm calling. Sorry, my toddler is running around. I am a speech therapist, so I had a question for your guest. And also, I know what jump the shark means. That comes from strangely enough, from Happy Days. There was, toward the end of that series, they were getting kind of desperate for plot lines, and they had Fonzie. I can't remember if he was some show he was near the ocean or whatever, but they actually had him, like, launch over a shark with his motorcycle, and that was taken as the show has gone way too far. It's time for it to be over. They've just jumped the shark.
That's,
you know, so that's what it's used for. And I've worked with many students with Asperger's and autism, and I'm just wondering if he has any suggestions for books, materials, anything, because besides teaching, you know, single instances of, you know, it's raining cats and dogs, what that means, so on and so forth, does he have any suggestions? Because it's very difficult to try to help the kids.
It is very difficult, and the only practical suggestion I can give is the book that I mentioned. It's called The Asperger's Dictionary of Everyday Expressions, and it has 5,000 different, you know, ordinary sayings that we use every day and very concise definitions of what they mean. The thing that I learned from talking with the person I interviewed for the book was, you know, there's very little. However, we had very long conversations about specific metaphors, like the belt tightening metaphor. And however I tried to explain it, she never really got it. So, and I think that might be, you know, we might be barking up the wrong tree to focus solely on that. What I learned from her is much more important. Is that other people who don't have Asperger's syndrome understand what this person is experiencing. And so that they, as the person sent the earlier email said, that they have the context to understand this person's behavior. A lot of the time, and you will know this much better than me since you work with people who have this condition, a lot of times people become angry and offended at someone's behavior because they don't understand the person has Asperger's or they don't understand what the consequences of that condition are. I think if we, and this is part of being sensitive to the use of metaphor in daily life, but in particular it has a unique relevance for people with this condition. If we can understand that, you know, they're flummoxed by an expression like, show me the ropes, then we can rephrase what it is we're trying to communicate in a way that's less metaphorical and hopefully more comprehensible. So I think what would be most beneficial to people with Asperger's and other forms of autism is if the people around them were more sensitized to that condition and what it involved.
Yes, thank you, Jill, very much for the call. Terry in Milwaukee. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'd like to highly recommend for any students of the Bible to do some research and study on the meaning of metaphors used in the Scriptures. There are a lot of metaphors that Bible writers use dealing with nautical terms, farming, agriculture, shepherding. Like, for example, there was an expression Jesus used about people, wicked people, being pitched into Gehenna. And many people believe that he was talking about some place of tormenty hell, when in fact he was talking about a dump right at the edge of Jerusalem where they threw garbage to burn it up for, you know, completely, so it was totally destroyed. There was no trace of it left. Reaping what you sow, Paul used the expression equipped for every good work, a nautical expression that sailors would understand quite well. If you were going to cast out to sea, being fully equipped meant having enough supplies to last you 6 months at sea in the unlikely event that you got stuck out there. So when people read older publications where metaphors were used decades or centuries ago, it really does help if they understand the meaning of those metaphors in trying to understand what thoughts are being conveyed.
James.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, all the great religious teachers taught in metaphors. Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, they all spoke in parables and spoke in metaphors. And it's exactly for the reason that the caller just explained. When you're trying to communicate something totally new and totally weird and unknown, the best way to do it is to describe it in terms of something that's familiar and tangible and around people every day. And, you know, Jesus, for example, if you want to stay with that example, he was called the fisher of men. So it makes perfect sense that he would use nautical metaphors and fishing metaphors, because a lot of the people who he was talking to made their living that way.
Mm. And we're out of time, but Lawrence from Madison says the bear metaphor used in a bear market is because bears hibernate. If a market is sluggish, it makes sense.
Uh-huh.
That makes
sense.
Thank
you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I've always thought I'd like to hibernate in the winter months. Wouldn't that be fun? I'm ready to hibernate. Well, you have been a bright light, and I thank you so much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. I will go through the day in a completely different way as a result of this. I'll be listening to people
so much,
very
Natalie.
Carefully. Thank you. Our guest this hour of the program, James Geary, G-E-A-R-Y. The book is I Is an Other, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the Way We See the World. It's fascinating. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thank you for all of your calls. You've just been spectacular today. We have been flooded with phone calls and also with many, many emails. So we'll be with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.